This is Keep It Juicy, episode 57. Hello, and welcome to Keep It Juicy, a weekly podcast that features experts on living a juicy life. What's a juicy life? It's a lifestyle for those who have put in a few miles and are ready to turn off-road, who are still learning and excited, who are fearless, or who are scared but dare anyway. Juicies are grown-ups, so some of our language may not be appropriate for children. Juicies are bold, passionate, and ready to squeeze every drop of juice out of life. I'm your host, Helen Mitternight. Are you ready? Let's keep it juicy. Hi, it's Helen Mitternight. Today we talk about the science that tells us when we should do almost everything in life. Author Dan Pink had us read his book, When, in a book club he runs called The Next Big Idea Club. I read it and I was fascinated. The stuff he discovered is so cool. I am so excited that today we talk with my buddy, author, and just nice guy, Dan Pink. We are here today with Dan Pink. Dan, thank you so much for being here.
Helen, it is a pleasure to be with you.
Do you want to be called Dan or Daniel on this podcast? I should ask you that.
Dan is fine.
Dan is fine. So for my listeners, just so that you know, I asked Dan to be on because he wrote this amazing book called When, but I have known Dan actually for a long time back when he was interested in solo entrepreneurs.
Yes, indeed.
He sent a camera crew to my house one time when I lived outside of D.C. None of us, they didn't speak English and I didn't speak their language. So they just filmed me sitting at my desk, which is really the most boring thing you could think of, but they managed to do something out of it. So thank you for that.
Sure.
And I wanted to talk about When. First of all, why did you write it? You've really been delving into a lot of things that make people's lives better. What got you interested in the timing of things?
It was really my own frustration, Helen, more than anything else, because I was, like all of us, was making all kinds of timing decisions in my own life. So, you know, when should I do my writing? When should I exercise? On a daily basis, but even things like when should I start a project? When should I stop a project that's not working? When is the best time in my life to make some kind of change? And so I was making all these kinds of decisions in a pretty sloppy way. I wanted to make it in a more evidence-based way. I looked around for guidance. It didn't exist, which really surprised me. And then, as you know, the last several books I've written have taken a look at what social science can tell us about a lot of these questions facing us in our work and in our lives. And I started looking around at the science, and to my amazement, there was a huge amount of science out there on this, on these very questions. It was challenging, though, because it was spread across many, many, many disciplines. So it was in economics, it was in anthropology, it was in cognitive science, but even in things like microbiology or really molecular biology and endocrinology and anesthesiology and a whole field called chronobiology. But I found that if I went deep enough into this vast body of research, I could begin to piece together the evidence-based ways to make really just better, smarter decisions about when to do things.
So I know some of it has to do with whether you're a morning person or a night person, which, you know, the larks and the night owls.
Right.
Talk to me about, okay, if you're, first of all, how do you find out other than sort of a general feeling? And then second, what does that mean? What do you do with that?
So you're right that we talk about morning people and evening people. And that sounds a little bit like it's folklore, but it's actually not. There is this entire field that I mentioned earlier called chronobiology. Chronotime biology, study of life, that looks at our biological rhythms, in particular how they play out over the course of a day. And so chronobiology has given us this idea that everybody has their own chronotype, which is essentially like, do you tend to wake up early and go to sleep early? Do you tend to wake up late and go to sleep late? And what we know is about 15% of us are pretty strong larks. We wake up early and go to sleep early. About 20% of us are very strong owls. We wake up late and go to sleep late. And then about two-thirds of us are in the middle, what I call third birds. And knowing that is the first step in figuring out the best time to do certain kinds of tasks. And the way to figure it out is relatively simple. There's some questionnaire, there's some assessments, scientifically validated assessments like the Munich Chronotype Questionnaire, the MCTQ, there's the Morning Eveningness Questionnaire, the MEQ. There's also a back of the envelope way to figure it out, which is to look at your midpoint of sleep on what's called a free day, a day when you don't have to wake up to an alarm clock. You're not catching up on sleep. So for me, I mean, this is the day that I'm talking to you is essentially a free day for me. I didn't have to wake up to an alarm clock. I don't have to go to sleep at any particular time. But for me, I typically just left to my own devices. I will typically go to sleep at about midnight and wake up at about 8. Okay. And so go to sleep at midnight, wake up at 8. My midpoint of sleep is 4 p.m. So if on your free days, your midpoint of sleep is before 3:30, you're probably a lark. If it's after 5:30, you're probably an owl. If it's in the middle, you're in the middle. And so I'm a somewhat larky middle person. That's actually a very, very common chronotype.
And then, so what does that mean for your life, knowing that?
Well, what that means, that's the first step in this kind of puzzle that we're trying to tease out about what's the best time to do certain kinds of work. And at a broad level, what we know is that, and this is really important, and I wish someone had told me this before I turned 50, because it would have been very helpful in the first half century of my life, which is our cognitive abilities, our brain power, does not remain constant over the course of a day. It changes, all right? Our brain power, our cognitive abilities change over the course of a day. They change in significant ways. They change in somewhat predictable ways. And how they change depends on what it is we're doing. So a way to think about it is this. Owls and non-owls. Owls and non-owls. So about 20% of us are owls, about 80% of us are not owls. For those of us who are not owls, we tend to move through the day in three phases. A peak, a trough, and a recovery. Peak, trough, recovery. Peak generally early in the day, trough early to mid-afternoon, recovery later in the day, late afternoon and early evening. Now, there's going to be some variance in there depending on, you know, if you're a super duper lark, your peak might start at 6 o'clock in the morning or some crazy thing like that. If you're somebody like me, you're more of a morning person, but you're not starting your day at those insanely oh dark 30 hours. So peak, trough, recovery. Now, what we know is this. During the peak, which again, for most of us is early in the day, that's when we should be doing our analytic work, work that requires heads down, focus, and attention, where you have to be, where the key thing here, and what comes out in all the research on this, is vigilance. During our peak, that's when our vigilance is highest. And vigilance simply means that you're harder to distract. And so that's when we should be doing work that benefits from not being distracted. Writing, analyzing data, carefully going over the steps of a strategy, that kind of work that requires you got to be locked in, heads down, and focus. Okay, so most of us should be doing that early in the day. The middle of the day, early to mid-afternoon, that's a pretty dangerous time of day. There's a lot of evidence showing that performance of doctors declines in there. So if you look at things like colonoscopies, doctors find half as many polyps in afternoon exams as they do in morning exams.
Yeah, that's when I get my extra hit of caffeine at that point in the day.
Well, that's probably a smart move. I mean, it's necessary, but not always sufficient. But you see big declines in performance in a way that I think most people don't realize. Like in there's big studies of standardized tests showing that kids perform worse in the afternoon than they do in the morning on many, many, many varieties of standardized tests. You see declines in certain kinds of corporate performance. You see big changes in healthcare. So during this that period, it's not the entire afternoon. It's really the early to mid-afternoon. That's when we should be doing, we're not at our cognitive best. So that's when we should be doing our administrative work, things that doesn't require massive brain power or creativity. So things like answering your routine emails is a good example of that, filling out your expense report. And then during the late afternoon and early evening, it's a very interesting time of day because our mood also changes over the course of a day. So our mood goes up, down, and then up again. Our mood goes back up later in the day, but we're less vigilant. And that makes it, that combination, increased mood and lower vigilance, makes it a good time for certain kinds of creative, iterative tasks, tasks that benefit from mental looseness, things like brainstorming. And so, again, for most of us, just trying to put a bow on this, and we'll get to Al's here in a second, we should be doing our analytic heads down work early in the day, during the peak, our administrative work in the early to mid-afternoon, and our creative work late in the day and in the early evening. That's true for about 80% of us.
So wait, before I do want to get to Al's, but I want to ask you a quick question. So if you are trying to schedule something, either a surgery or a stock report or something like that, should you just play the odds and schedule it when 80% of the people are likely to be at their peak?
Oh, okay. That's a very, very good question. So let's talk about healthcare, all right? And here I think the evidence is overwhelming, and it's actually, Helen, changed how I do things in my own life, okay? I will not go to an important doctor appointment or anything in a hospital in the afternoon, period, full stop. The evidence is too strong that afternoon performance in hospitals and doctors is not the same as morning performance, period, full stop. So, I have finally reached the age where good judgment requires having a colonoscopy, and because I know we all love to talk about our own colonoscopies.
So, oh yeah,
I
had best sleep ever, by the way.
in October, I had a colonoscopy, and I scheduled it for 9:15 in the morning because any kind of serious medical procedure in the afternoon. When my younger daughter had her wisdom teeth taken out about 6 or 7 months ago, she had to have general anesthesia. There is no way that she was getting general anesthesia in the afternoon, period, full stop. We know from the evidence that anesthesia errors are 4 times more likely at 3 p.m. than at 9 a.m. So in that case, no question about it. If you have a choice, do not go to the hospital or do not go to an important doctor's appointment in the afternoon.
I'm surprised they schedule procedures in the afternoon, given the overwhelming evidence like that.
Well, there are ways. It's a great point, and there are ways around it. There are remedies that various hospital systems and physicians have done. One of those things, which is actually taking breaks, So in the book, I actually write about standing in a surgery at the University of Michigan, where the doctors had timeouts and checklists and things like that, so that they literally stood around the patient and then they said timeout. Then they took a timeout, they took a step back, they went over everything very carefully to maintain that vigilance that sometimes erodes in the afternoon. Here's the thing, we know, and it's a great point in general. We know that our brain power changes over the course of a day, but it doesn't mean that we can simply shut down every office in America when people aren't at their best. So we do have to make certain kinds of accommodations, whether it's in the form of breaks, or more important, whether it's in the form of being much more intentional and deliberate about when we do things, when we schedule meetings, when we do our own work, when the boss tells people to do this thing or that thing. And again, circling back to this point, for about 80% of us, you should be doing our analytic work early in the day, generally in the morning, our administrative work in the early to mid-afternoon, and then our creative work later in the day. And if you can just scooch some of that work to different times of day, there are significant improvements in both output and also in just general satisfaction.
So then quickly tell me about the owls so that we don't leave them out.
No, I don't want to leave out the owls because the world, the corporate world especially, is really unfriendly to owls. Now owls, again, owls just by their very nature, wake up late, go to sleep late. So an 8 a.m. staff meeting is torture. The thing we know about owls, and the most important thing about owls is this. Owls reach their analytic peak much later in the day, late afternoon, well into the evening. So owls are better doing their writing, their financial analysis, their hardcore software coding later in the day and in the evenings. And so owls are much more complicated than the rest of us. But if you have workplaces that says, all right, owl, you don't have to be here for that 8 a.m. meeting because I know you're going to be cranking at 7 o'clock at night or 9 o'clock at night when everybody else is home. And so what we want to do you and I first met when I was writing about people who had left large organizations to go out on their own as freelancers and e-lancers and self-employed professionals and solopreneurs and blah, 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 blah. You know, a reason that people left large organizations was because they didn't want to abide by somebody else's schedule.
I remember that. Yeah.
So if we just do so all of which is to say is that we have this recipe out there. We have the evidence showing that again, our brain power doesn't remain constant over the course of a day. It changes in significant ways. And the best time to do something depends on what it is that we're doing. But we have a roadmap for how to make those choices in a better, smarter way.
And let's talk about naps. Can you reset that by sleeping in the middle of the day or at a certain point?
You can't reset that, but the evidence on naps, which I write about actually in chapter 2 of the book, really blew me away. I was never a napper, or I would nap occasionally, and I always felt terrible afterwards. And what I discovered in looking at the research on naps is that, A, naps are very good for us, but B, the best naps are extremely short, shorter than I would have ever imagined. So the naps that do the best in they don't quite give us a reset, but they can restore some of our energy, restore some of our mental acuity. Those naps tend to be between about 10 and 20 minutes long. If it's less than 10 minutes, it doesn't have much of a benefit. If it's longer than 20 minutes, you begin to develop what's called sleep inertia, which is that groggy, boggy feeling you sometimes get if you wake up from a midday nap. And so you have to dig out of that sleep inertia before you get any of the benefits of the nap. So naps are good as a restorative, but the best naps, the most efficacious naps, are between 10 and 20 minutes long.
And wasn't there, I read every word of the book, but I'm trying to remember, wasn't there something about drinking coffee before you sleep or something, right?
Indeed, yeah. If you really want to go for it, if you really want to be the elite napper, there is a scientifically sound recipe for the perfect nap, and it goes like this. And I've done this. I didn't do it today, but I've done. I think the last time I did it was last week. So what you do is what I do is this. So I have an office here. It's my little garage here behind my house, and I sit in a chair in that office, and I set my phone timer for 25 minutes, and then I put on my noise canceling headphones. And then, before I turn on the phone, before I turn on the timer, the countdown timer, I drink a cup of coffee. And the coffee is, I don't drink it for enjoyment at all. I just I brew a cup of coffee, and I plunk 3 or 4 ice cubes in it and just gulp it down. So I drink that cup of coffee. Then I close my eyes. And at this point, napping is in some ways a little bit like meditation or, you know, indeed many things in life. You get better at it the more you do it. And so I can usually fall asleep in 10 minutes, 9 or 10 minutes. So let's say I fall asleep. So I set the alarm for 25, starts counting down. I've drunk my coffee. Let's say I can get to sleep and fall asleep in 9 minutes. My alarm goes off after 25 minutes. So I've gotten a 16-minute nap, which is right in that sweet spot between 10 and 20. But then it turns out it takes caffeine about 25 minutes to get into your bloodstream. So at that moment that I'm waking up from that perfectly timed nap, that 16-minute nap, I'm getting a dose of caffeine, which is going to give me a secondary boost. So this technique is known as a nappuccino. And it is the
it blew me away when I read about it.
I kid you not. And there are actually several papers on this. You can I mean, you know, I one of the things that I've done in my books ever since I started writing books is I put footnotes in the text itself. No end notes, no kind of haziness. So if I make a claim or cite a study or anything like that, I put a footnote right there. People can go to the end. People can go to the notes at the back of the book and say, "Oh, footnote 14 on page 128 cites this particular study in Italy from 2017 about caffeine consumption and napping." So, absolutely, I kid you not, Nappuccino is the scientifically proven most effective nap.
I love it. So, all right, talk to me about beginnings, middles, ends. I know you say beginnings are super important. Why is that?
Well, the evidence tells us that beginnings are super important. And a way to look at this is if we think about our lives, our lives are in many ways a series of episodes. We sometimes sort of the rational part of our brain sometimes deludes us into thinking that life is this purely linear progression, when in fact it's a series of episodes. Each day is a series of episodes. A project is a series of episodes. A career is a series of episodes. Being a parent is a series of episodes. And episodes, by their nature, have beginnings, middles, and ends. And each of those points exerts a different effect on our behavior. So beginnings have one effect, middles have another effect, and endings have another effect. Beginnings are really important for a couple of ways, in a number of different ways. So on the one hand, beginnings can have a huge effect on shaping our overall trajectory in any kind of domain. To me, one of the most alarming aspects of this is the research, a lot of it from a woman named Lisa Kahn, who's an economist at Yale, showing that for people who go to college, the unemployment rate the year you graduate from college can predict your earnings 20 years later. That you will earn more 20 years later, if you graduate from college in a boom time rather than in a recession. Because that initial trajectory you're on has a huge and long-term effect. There are other things, though, about how beginnings give us a clean slate, and how you can actually do some rebooting with something that researchers call the fresh start effect. So all kinds of things on beginnings to help us be more aware of how things are working, but also be more intentional about it as well.
I guess that's why people forever optimistically make resolutions. Right.
It's exactly right. Because here's the thing, that's precisely right. The fresh start effect is based on something in the social science known as temporal landmarks. So there are certain dates that stand out in time the same way that certain places stand out in physical space as landmarks. And so what happens with these temporal landmarks is that when people reach them, they slow down, they reassess, but they also do this peculiar form of mental accounting. So what they will do is they will say, right, we've hit a certain temporal landmark. They'll essentially open up a fresh ledger on themselves, close the old ledger, open up a fresh ledger. And it's a little bit delusional in a way, but psychologically it's very common, and it can be really, really effective. And so what this means, so you're right. So New Year's resolutions, New Year's Day is a quintessential temporal landmark. Oh, wow. You know, it's like you're driving along and you've left one state and you've entered another state. Whoa, that's a landmark. Or you passed by something that's very familiar to you. And so New Year's Day is a landmark, temporal landmark. And what we do on those kinds of days is that we relegate our old selves to the past. I'm closing the ledger on old Dan who, you know, always ate crappy food. And opening up a fresh ledger on new Dan who won't eat crappy food.
It almost seems. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No. Go ahead.
I said it almost seems like we need ritual to mark that turning of a page. You know, there are so many rituals that you write out things that you want to get rid of and you burn them, and nothing has changed. But in your mind, you've sort of reset. Like, okay, that habit is gone. Yeah. I've burned it. Poof.
Right. Right, and it doesn't. Yeah, and again, it's easy to sort of poo-poo these kinds of things, and in my view, New Year's resolutions get a terrible rap, because what happens is they'll say, oh, you know, people don't keep half, you know, people don't keep half of their resolutions. And my, and I look at that and say, wait, people keep the other half? Like, well, that's amazing. It's so hard to change our behavior. And this deploying the fresh start effect is a way to do it. And so this is why if you want to make some kind of behavior change, whether it's, you know, a new diet or a new exercise regimen or whatever, you know, you're better off starting it on, you know, a Monday rather than a Wednesday. You're better off starting it on the day after your birthday rather than 3 days before your birthday.
Makes sense. Well, so tell me, one of the things that I read in your book that I had, I loved everything about it. I agreed with everything. It all sort of made sense. And the one thing I had this sort of intuitive pushback on was this notion of editing friends as you get older. Because I feel like I'm still trying to collect and gather. But you talk about it's not a lonely thing. It's an actual deliberate thing that people do as they get older, right?
Yeah, this is interesting. This is the work of Laura Carstensen at Stanford. And what she found, she was looking at the size of friend networks, over time. Not like social networks, not like Facebook, but just like real friends. And what she found is that after the age of about 60, the size of people's friendship networks declined significantly, which seems, as you say, like kind of a sad, superficially like a sad story. When in fact, as she looked deeper, Carstensen found that what was happening is that people were, if you ask people, she asked people to group their friends into, you know, the inner circle, second circle, and an outer circle. So the inner circle, people you absolutely cannot live without. The next circle are people who you're very close to. The circle beyond that are people who you really, really like. And what you found is that after about the age of 60, people ended up concentrating much, much, much more on that inner circle, and essentially shedding those two outer circles. And this is a phenomenon. Now, I think what's interesting about that, and she has actually experimental evidence showing this, is that as longevity increases, the moment at which you do that will become later and later and later.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And so so you see that she also found this phenomenon in other domains. That is, it's an effect of endings. When we sense the end of something, when the end of something becomes more salient, we tend to focus ever more on meaning and purpose and significance. And so what she found is that this pattern where essentially over the course of a lifetime, you start out with a relatively small friendship network. The friendship network grows and grows and grows and grows and grows. And then when you hit a certain point in your life, and for her, the demarcation was about 60. But again, as I said, she has other research, experimental research, showing that if you say to people, oh, imagine a magical drug has been invented and you're going to live to be 120 years old, people will postpone that editing significantly. So it's really a question of having the end be salient. Because she found a very similar phenomenon, basically the same shape in the size of friendship networks over the course of a college career. So if you look at, you know, people in their 4 years of college, you know, let's say you people who go to a 4-year residential college, you know, they will, you know, start out without many friends. And then over the first 3 years or so, they'll build a large friendship network. But then when you see their behavior, say their senior year, they have begun concentrating on their inner circle and shedding those two outer circles. And it's a very common phenomenon of endings of any kind. Endings seem to increase our need for purpose, connection, relatedness, significance.
Fascinating. So last question is, what of all the things that you learned in this for this book, what surprised you the most?
Wow. I was surprised by a lot of things, Helen. So I was really surprised. I don't know if there was a single one that surprised me the most. One of the things that surprised me the most was, I'll give you two. One of them was, as we were talking about earlier, just how big the effect is of time of day on our performance and brain power. I mean, I had an intuitive sense, like, okay, maybe there's a little bit of difference. There's a huge difference over the course of a day in how our brains operate, how good we are at what we do. That's one thing. The other thing, I guess, that really surprised me, this really did surprise me, is in the chapter on how groups synchronize in time, I looked at some of the research on choirs and choral singing. And that research absolutely blew my mind. Choral singing, singing in a choir, not singing by yourself, not singing per se or singing by yourself, but singing in a choir, that is so unbelievably good for you. It's as good for you as exercise. It's a prophylactic against depression. It raises people's pain thresholds. It deepens their sense of connection and meaning. It has a physiological effect. It actually improves their immune response. It's really just extraordinary. And so and you see this in other kinds of synchronized behavior. There's something about when we human beings synchronize, work in time with other people, that is transcendent, that is that has a ginormous effect on our body and our minds and arguably on our souls.
Wow. I'm just because of speaking of time, we're going to have to leave it there. I could talk to you all day about this stuff. But of course, I'm probably entering my own low point of the day anyway, right?
Yeah, no, but this stuff, but I think, I mean, I'm glad to hear you say that, because one of the things that I learned in writing this is that, you know, time matters more than we think. You know, we're very intentional about what we do and how we do it and who we do it with, but we're less intentional about when we do things over the course of a day, over the course of a lifetime. And these decisions about when to do stuff really, really matter. They matter to our ability to get good work done. They also matter to our just ability to lead a good life.
Thank you so much. Listeners, I will absolutely have the link on the website for where you can buy when. And Dan, thank you so much for being here.
Helen, it's a pleasure.
If you want to read more about Dan Pink, get his book, When, or find out about the next Big Idea Book Club, check out the General Resources page on our website, keepitjuicy.com. Next week, on a mini episode, I talk about what psychology tells us about why we give. You can keep up with us on Facebook or Twitter at keepitjuicy.com, or go to my website and sign up for the newsletter. And it really helps if you go into iTunes and leave a review. Meanwhile, go out there and keep it juicy.